Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Valerie Plame Wilson. She's a former CIA covert operations officer and author of the book Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
You joined the CIA in the mid-1980s, and you worked overseas. And then some years into your career, you became part of the Counterproliferation Division. Our listeners probably all know what nonproliferation is, but what is counterproliferation?
I think it's a way of saying that we are pushing back against proliferation efforts by either rogue nations or non-state actors. That is, you know, terrorists and other people who might wish to do the United States harm.
Your expertise was in the area of weapons of mass destruction, including in the Middle East. How did what you knew about Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction compared to what George W. Bush was saying to the public about the same subject in 2002, namely that Saddam was close to making nuclear weapons?
Well, let me start with the assumptions going in the run-up to the war. Don't forget we are in the shadow of 9/11, and Saddam Hussein, there was no doubt he's was truly an evil tyrant. He had used WMD on his own people. He kicked out the UN weapons inspectors in 1998, so our intelligence was very thin on what he had, what he was doing. And as we now know all too well, that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, our attention shifted quickly from Afghanistan to Iraq, and there was a huge effort and focus on Iraq or what they had. And at the time, I was working on a task force within the Counterproliferation Division devoted to trying to find out what the scientists in these programs were up to. What was the state of their research? What did they have? Where were they trying to procure their equipment? And that's what the operations I was running at that time were involved with.
You say the aftermath of 9/11. We knew then, and we know now that there were no links between Al Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. So, what is the connection that you're making?
We know that for sure now. Despite even recent efforts by the vice president to make that link, what I was trying to say was, however, that certainly the country felt under siege. And I don't think that Saddam Hussein should have been given the benefit of the doubt.
So in February 2002, a request came to the CIA from the vice president's office to investigate a report that Iraq had tried to buy yellowcake uranium from Niger. Was this a typical request between the White House and the CIA?
Not in the way it unfolded. What happened was a young woman, an officer who worked for me, normally pretty reserved and unflappable, came to me in quite a state because she had received a phone call on her desk from someone in the office of the vice president requesting further information on this alleged transaction from Niger to Iraq of yellowcake uranium. Now, we have protocols, we have channels, we have ways, established ways, for senior policymakers, if they have questions or want clarification on intelligence they received, you don't just ring up a junior officer at their desk at CIA headquarters and say, you know, what else do you have here? So that was very strange. And at the time, I was completely unaware of the unprecedented number of visits to CIA headquarters by both President Cheney and his then Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby, to speak to analysts about what they had on Iraq.
You wrote that these
requests and these visits that you're mentioning created an environment in which some analysts felt they were being pressured to make their assessments fit with the Bush administration's policy objectives. And yet you also wrote in your book the idea that your government, which you had served loyally for years, might be exaggerating a case for the war, was impossible to comprehend. How did you put these different pieces together at the time?
Well, as I said, I don't think any of us were aware of all these visits by the vice president to CIA headquarters. But it wasn't until Secretary Powell's speech to the UN in February of 2003, right on the eve of war, that I experienced what I call in my book cognitive dissonance. Because what I heard him say and the cases he was citing did not match up with the intelligence that I knew, and I was privy to quite a bit. In particular, he spoke about this one case, Curveball, that was like the primary case that there was an Iraqi mobile biological weapons lab. And this was so strange because Curveball's reporting had been entirely discredited.
Now, Curveball was a source.
That's right. That was the code name for this source, an Iraqi scientist. But the CIA never met with him. He was under the German control. And we knew that his reporting was highly questionable. And when I was watching this when I was watching Powell on TV, I turned to the woman next to me who had followed that particular case much more closely than I, and I said, "What is going on?" And I'm sure her face looked like mine, which was just disbelief. And she said, "I have no idea." And I was really just praying that there were others above my pay grade that had access of intelligence that could support the administration's rhetoric that there was an imminent threat, because I certainly did not see it in what we had.
But at that point, your suspicions began to be aroused?
Yeah, I would say up to that point, my heads were sort of in the operational weeds. I was so busy. I was running worldwide operations, trying to make sure that they were effective, they were secure, that we were doing everything we possibly could. It was a very frenzied atmosphere because we knew our time was running out. And I was just trying to do, as all of us, do the best job we possibly could. But it really wasn't until Powell's speech to the UN that I had this sense that what the administration was saying was truly not matching up with the intelligence, and it had been manipulated.
In looking for the truth in the matter of the yellow cake uranium, your husband, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, was brought in to make a visit to Niger, and he was an expert in African affairs. Is this kind of collaboration between the CIA and the State Department personnel typical, or is it unusual?
Well, at the time he made the trip in February 2002, he was actually retired from the State Department. It is not unusual for the CIA to reach out to U.S. citizens that are in the right place at the right time. How that happened, to go back to when this young woman is telling me about this report, a reports officer came by, heard what was going on, and he said, "Well, what about Joe?" And the reason he said, "What about Joe?" was because he knew his credentials, that Joe had lived and worked in Africa as a diplomat for over 20 years. He knew most of the leaders on the continent by first name. He had also served as a chargé d'affaires at our embassy in Baghdad during the first Gulf War. He had met with Saddam Hussein and had helped, in fact, obtain the safe release of many American hostages. And Joe had also gone, he was a known quantity to the CIA. He had undertaken some earlier missions on similar issues. So when the reports officer said, "Well, what about Joe?" He didn't just pull that name out of thin air. He knew Joe's credentials and bona fides he was well placed to perhaps get some answers back to the vice president's office.
Nor did you suggest it as accusations later went.
No, I didn't. We went to my boss. We told him what was going on, and my boss said to me, "Well, Val, when you go home tonight, can you please ask Joe to come into CIA headquarters next week, and let's see what's you know, what we're going to do with this. And could you also please send an email to the chief of the division and let him know what was going on? And it was that email that later was excerpted truly out of context and reprinted in a report by Republican senators that said I had suggested or recommended Joe for this trip, which was not the case.
We know from the piece that your husband published later in the New York Times that the Yellowcake claims were unsubstantiated. To whom did your husband report these findings, and what was done with that information?
As soon as he came back from Niger, literally as he's getting out of the taxi, the reports officer who had originally suggested him and another one met him at our home then in Washington, and they debriefed him. We had small twins at home at the time. I was not present at the debriefing. We ordered out dinner that night, so we had a social meal, but I had no idea of what the report was. The next day when the report was written up, the reports officer showed it to me as a courtesy, but I did not edit it, I did not change it, and then it was distributed throughout the regular intelligence channels, and we assumed, of course, back to the office of the vice president.
We're speaking with Valerie Plame Wilson. The U.S. began its invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, and something that I found interesting in your book was that you had serious reservations about the invasion because you felt that there might be WMD that the CIA had been unable to locate that could have been turned against U.S. soldiers.
Exactly. I was absolutely sick. I felt that we had failed, that we just didn't find the right scientists. We just had not looked under the right rock, that we should have believed someone when we didn't, or vice versa. And I was absolutely terrified that we had missed what we needed to protect U.S. troops.
At the same time, there was another interesting piece that I've really never heard talked about, and that is that you thought that Saddam Hussein wanted the world to think that they had WMD in order to ward off a possible attack from Israel.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? You know, he was very clever, and he manipulated his closest circle. Some of them thought they actually did, that Iraq actually did have WMD. Others knew that they did not. He was, obviously, as a tyrant is, extremely controlling, not only for his international relations and his relationship in the region, but for his own domestic power control.
One of the ironies that you pointed out is that the invasion actually gave rise to the looting of Iraqi nuclear facilities. What actually happened?
Well, how ironic is that?
Exactly. I know.
I think it was from BBC reports that there were facilities that were being looted. And then when this was surfaced and reported by the BBC, the State Department sort of downplayed all that. But there's no question that there was complete chaos in the weeks following the invasion. The reports, of course, of the Baghdad Museum being looted and what we saw on the streets, you know, televisions being carried out by the cartload out of stores. The entire country was turned upside down.
So what happened to that nuclear material? Does anybody know to this day?
I don't think so.
Well, on the 6th of July, 2003, your husband, Joseph Wilson's piece came out in the Sunday New York Times. It was called What I Didn't Find in Africa. What happened next? It was about basically substantiating that there really was not this Yellowcake uranium transfer. What happened after that?
Precisely. He refuted the administration's primary claim for going to war with Iraq, which was the nuclear threat. What happened was the very next day the White House issued a statement saying indeed that these now infamous 16 words did not rise to the level of inclusion in the State of the Union address. And Joe thought that he had made his point, which was to understand and make sure that the government, the administration, had come clean with how this whopper had gotten into the State of the Union address. So he literally turned off his cell phone and went to play golf.
And next thing you knew, your name was in the paper.
Yes. On the 14th of July, a week later, Joe came into our bedroom very early in the morning and threw the paper on the bed and said, well, he did it. And I opened up the paper and I read Novak's column, and I was just completely mortified. All the concerns for my network of assets, for my family's security, for my career, you know, went through my head in about an instant.
So basically,
mortifying.
Journalist Robert Novak had said Valerie Plame, wife of Joseph Wilson, who wrote this article, is a covert CIA operative.
That's correct.
And what are the potential dangers when a covert operations officer like you it gets outed like that? What are the operations to you, your family, and others?
Well, that's why it's treasonous, and I measure my words carefully, because it not only affects my network of assets, but, of course, there's the ripple effect. There might be a future source in some foreign country who has information of critical intelligence to our national security, and they think to themselves, now, why should I put myself or my family's lives on the line, because sometimes, indeed, that is what is asked of them, when they hear this story? They couldn't even protect one of their own. Why? They're thinking, why should I do this? And maybe I'll just go sell my information to the Russians down the street.
So it was really like for you and for your husband being punched in the stomach. How did your colleagues and your superiors at the CIA respond?
Well, I think initially there was bipartisan outrage, and certainly had a great deal of support within the agency. But as the saga continued to unfold and it got increasingly bitter, and the whole character assassination campaign began against my husband and then me, I sensed that my colleagues backed away a little bit. Because I liken it to sort of when there's, you know, say a colleague of yours in the workplace, there's a death in their family. Sometimes you just don't know what to say, and it's hard to know if they're sympathetic or they just are staying away. They don't know what to say.
David Korn of The Nation magazine was the first one to talk about the potential illegality of this outing. What laws were violated?
There's something called the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, the IIPA, that was drafted in the wake of Philip Agee's betrayal. He was a CIA agent who then went to the Soviets and wrote a book with agents' names. So they drafted this law to make it illegal to publicize. CIA officers' names. The problem was that I think the law was poorly written, and I do hope at some point in the future Congress will revisit it and perhaps close some of the loopholes and make sure that the bar is not so high, because as we have seen in this case, they were not able to prosecute on the basis of that law, and it needs to be reworked so that this doesn't happen again in the future.
Just out of curiosity, what was the nature of the loophole?
I don't know the law closely enough, but what we do know is that Mr. Libby was convicted of obstruction of justice. And what a lot of the brightest minds in Washington can't seem to understand is that means that the prosecutor, Fitzgerald, could not get to the bottom of the case. As he said, it was like throwing sand in the umpire's eyes. When you can't, the prosecutor did an outstanding job, but he could not finally get to the bottom of what exactly happened because there was obstruction of justice.
And we'll get to that more in a moment. I'd love to know for you to tell us the story of where the title of your book comes from, Fair Game.
Yes, that comes from a remark that Karl Rove made to Washington journalist Chris Matthews. He said, well, Wilson's wife is fair game. So when the time came to look for a title for my book, I thought of that I thought it worked well because it works on many levels.
So Karl Rove actually was sitting there. I mean, the word that you use in your book is gossiping with journalists, saying that outing a CIA agent is fair game for basically purely partisan political reasons.
Indeed. Although he wasn't, I wouldn't ascribe to him so much as gossip. I think Karl Rove knew exactly what he was doing, and this was payback to Joe Wilson because he had the audacity to challenge the administration's case for war. It was the under Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, who actually admitted to sort of gossiping and providing my name both to Mr. Novak and then to journalist Bob Woodward. And I just say, what a foolish man. He'd been in Washington for decades. He should have known better. He might not have known Armitage's exactly where in the CIA worked, but that didn't matter. You see someone's name in the CIA, that's a red flag. And that is one of the reasons he's included in our civil suit.
Piecing it all together, as you've done over time, how many journalists were told about your covert CIA identity, and by whom? How many people were doing the telling?
At least half a dozen. And, we certainly know, to your question about who exactly was speaking to journalists, I'd have to, you know, certainly Mr. Libby, Mr. Rove, Ari Fleischer, who was then the press secretary, as Patrick Fitzgerald put into a filing, he can't conceive of any evidence that would disprove a conspiracy by multiple people in the White House to undermine and discredit Joe Wilson.
In October 2003, you were questioned by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. What was the purpose of this inquiry, and what was its result?
Their purpose, they were putting together a report on how the pre-war intelligence was used. And I was interviewed as part of that process. And at the time, I testified absolutely truthfully that I did not recall exactly how Joe's name had gotten to the mix. Don't forget, this is over a year and a half later. We'd gone through a war. Joe's report, when it came back, had basically said there's no there there. I was extremely busy running these operations, and I testified truthfully. I don't know exactly how this came about. When the report was finally released in July 2004, there was a section entitled The Additional Views, written exclusively by four Republican senators that accused me of having suggested or recommended Joe for his trip, thereby suggesting nepotism in this. And they came to all kinds of erroneous conclusions, including that Joe's report actually had persuaded some analysts that that this transaction, this alleged transaction of yellow cake uranium ore from Niger to Iraq had taken place. And I tell you, it was like...
I thought that was the opposite of what it said.
Well, I'm telling you, it was like falling down the rabbit hole where white is black and black is white.
Yeah.
And the next day, after the report's release, the reports officer who had originally suggested Joe came into my office at the CIA, shut the door, sat down, and almost burst into tears. And he said, they twisted my testimony. I'm the one who recommended Joe. Don't you remember? And I was frozen. I didn't know what to tell him to do. I certainly didn't want to be accused of witness tampering. He went back and asked his supervisor if he could retestify, and that was denied. He wrote a memo for the record, which he showed me but did not give me, that laid out events exactly as they had transpired, that he had suggested Joe, that I had nothing to do with it, and so on.
Well, but, I think one of the things that's...
That was never
go
made public. Yeah, that's
well,
all.
I mean, it is sort of odd that there's this accusation of nepotism when your husband really didn't get anything out of it. He wasn't even paid for doing the trip.
That's right. He went on a pro bono basis. Only his travel expenses were paid. And anyone who knows anything about Niger would never presume to call it a junket or a boondoggle. It is literally the poorest nation in the world. And what was at work here are forces at trying to make it seem if there was nepotism involved or his wife somehow got him the job, then that would undermine what his report said.
We're talking to Valerie Plame Wilson, former CIA covert operations officer and author of the book Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. Allegations came from various sources after that your own husband had leaked your identity.
Well, that and one of them was on the editorial pages of the Washington Post. And I can tell you, again, it felt surreal because the Washington Post, which, by the way, had supported the war in Iraq strongly, had supported this administration, chose to blame Joe for something that the prosecutor had clearly shown was the fault of senior administration officials.
So what happened when Patrick Fitzgerald was appointed to lead the investigation of this leak of your name?
He was appointed when, at the time, the Attorney General, Mr. Ashcroft, recused himself because of his close ties to Karl Rove, who clearly was a target of the investigation. So Mr. Fitzgerald came on board, and he interviewed me, I think it was in like February 2004, and I just told him everything that I knew. I found him to be very direct. He was a good listener, and all that Joe and I wanted was a robust and fair investigation. That's all we could ask for.
So Scooter Libby was indicted and convicted of four of the five counts against him, including, as you said, obstruction of justice. Many signs in your case pointed to Karl Rove and Dick Cheney. Why do you think they were not indicted?
That's a question you'll have better put to the prosecutor. Mr. Rove testified before the grand jury five times, and I don't know about you, but I certainly wouldn't want to testify before any grand jury five times.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it comes down to the obstruction of justice, not being able to get to the very bottom. But the prosecutor left no doubt that there was a cloud over the office of the vice president.
Have there been repercussions, negative repercussions, to the vice president that have been the lasting result of this, do you think?
Well, in general, I think it's fair to say that the vice president is seen as a real detriment to this administration. He is discredited, and now he's certainly seen as banging the drum for war with Iran. He has a very strange view of the world.
Taking a step back, where did the false information about the Niger yellow cake uranium come from in the first place? And what investigation has there been into this false information?
The bottom of it still remains a mystery. We do know that there were these forged documents. There's no question about that. And a book has been written about this by a journalist, Newt Royce, and someone else whose name I can't recall. I think it's called The Italian Papers. And they go as far as they possibly can on how these forged documents came to light, how anybody gave them credibility. But I don't think anyone yet has been able to discover where exactly these documents originated from.
You note in your book the deep irony in the contrast between you know, the persecuting the messenger, your husband, and ignoring the message, namely the yellow cake story.
Well, that's what supporters of this administration do. When the facts are deemed to be irrelevant or they don't suit their political agenda, they're pushed aside. And instead, they launched a 4.5-year-long character assassination campaign. They called Joe a liar, a traitor, and unpatriotic, and worse. I've been accused of nepotism. It really has been quite something to live through.
And this, one of the subtitles of your book is My Betrayal by the White House. And the story is one of betrayal on many levels, betrayal by the government that outed you, but also by the CIA itself that denied your requests for security when you were getting death threats, and then the CIA's Publications Review Board that tried to keep you from publishing your book.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was so proud to serve my country, and I love my career, and I derived a great sense of satisfaction on working on these counterproliferation issues. But yes, I was deeply disappointed. I was crushed when I asked for security for a small period of time on my residence because we had received serious and credible threats. And they denied that. Very bad decision. And then having gone through the last year and a half of trying to work with the CIA, there's the board that is charged with making sure that there's no classified information in public materials called the Publication Review Board, the PRB. And it has been very clear to me that the CIA has allowed itself to be used as a tool in a domestic political issue, because I can assure you that the vast majority of what is underneath those many redacted lines in the book has everything to do with seeking to punish me and Joe and diminish me further, much more than protecting classified information.
Well, I love that it got published with these lines blackened out so that the censorship is there for everybody to see. Did you actually rewrite any parts of the book in order to get it published?
Well, I have. I should start with the caveat, if you will, that the CIA has prohibited me from acknowledging any agency affiliation prior to January 2002, despite the vast amount of information
the fact that
available.
It's in Wikipedia.
No, despite the vast amount of information available on my background and my career. And I, like every CIA officer who comes on board, I signed a secrecy agreement, and I have fully upheld my responsibilities in that regard. I'm an intelligence professional. I have no desire to jeopardize or reveal classified information. But as we went through this, and we tried to cooperate as closely as we could, it was very clear that they were going far beyond their mandate in keeping out classified information, and it was treading on First Amendment rights, as well as going into censorship territory. So we sued them. My publisher, Simon & Schuster, and I, they had a great deal of courage to join with me. We sued the CIA this summer. And in the course of that, the government submitted a classified brief to the judge in the case that neither I nor my lawyers were permitted to see, which was, just adds to the strangeness of it all. And unfortunately, we lost the first round, but we are appealing. And my lawyers have kindly put together a website called fairgameplaying.com that provides all the court documents and, I think, very easy to read and understand background on this case. And although it's only a little piece of the story, it's an important piece because I would submit that this is part of a larger, broader pattern of behavior by this administration to intimidate its critics and to use fear and national security as a bludgeon to perpetuate their own political agenda.
Let's talk about the news media. Who do you think have been the most thorough and responsible in reporting on your story, and who have been the most vicious and dishonest? There's quite a lot of both that you discuss in your book.
You sound like you want me to name names. well, I will say this in the in Mr. Libby's trial, a lot came out. And a couple things that struck me, besides the recklessness with which these senior administration officials have tossed around my name, was the role of, I would say, actually the symbiotic relationship between the Washington Press Corps and the administration. Now, that is not news. That happens all the time. But to the extent to which this administration has gone to threaten to cut off access to White House reporters if they didn't like something that they wrote is quite something. And, you know, if that's your beat and they're threatening to cut off access, then you're in a world of hurt. And I'm not sure what the fix is for that. But it was also very clear in the trial and subsequent news reports on this, because I do think the media is doing some searching, is that they, frankly, very few news outlets wore out any shoe leather trying to understand exactly what was going on in the run-up to the war. A lot of them were simply spoon-fed whatever was the message of the day from the White House, and they took it without talking to mid-level managers throughout the Pentagon and other bits of official Washington. And had they bothered to do that, they would have found a very different story about post-war planning and the whole how the war was prosecuted than what they were being fed from the administration.
Well, I find it fascinating that the progressive media, who are in general most critical of the CIA and who will gladly write stories about secret prisons and Iran-Contra and so on, were more supportive and more truthful and more investigative of your case than the right-wing media who normally support the CIA's activities.
Well, I'll tell you why, because this is not, at the heart of it, this is not a political issue. This is not about being Republican or Democratic. This is about national security. And the treasonous actions on behalf of these senior administration officials really did a grave violence to our national security. And the progressive media got that. I think Americans of all political stripes want to hope and believe that whatever intelligence lands on the president's desk, it is free from ideological taint, because otherwise, obviously, the product is distorted, the mission is corrupted, and our national security suffers as a result.
We're talking to Valerie Plame Wilson, author of the book Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. I have to honestly say that I found it a little disturbing, not only in light of your case, that at the CIA, Fox News is always on TV. Did your perception of the media and outlets like Fox change as a result of what you went through?
I think it's fair to say that in general, this is a sweeping generalization, but that's what they do, that many of the employees of the CIA trend conservative in their outlook. No surprise there. And I put that in there, that little tidbit, that, you know, you go into most CIA offices and the news is turned to Fox, which I think is really more valuable for its entertainment rather than for any fair and balanced news.
You write in your book about the tension between reporters' confidential sources and their need and right to keep their sources confidential on the one hand, and the using of reporters by government officials on the other hand. Examples, Matt Cooper and Judith Miller. What was the nature of the relationship between, for example, Judith Miller and Scooter Libby?
I don't know. That's a question better for Judith Miller. But what I was trying to make the point is that this was Watergate or the Pentagon Papers turned on its head. These reporters were trying to protect sources that had lied to them or were using them in a propaganda effort. And that's a whole discussion for Journalistic Ethics 101. But and admittedly, I am biased, but I sure as heck wanted to hear what Judith Miller and Matt Cooper had to say, and apparently so did the prosecutor, because he thought that their responsibilities as citizens came before their responsibilities as journalists, particularly in this case.
You and your husband, Joe Wilson, have filed suits against Cheney, Libby, and Rove. What is
Ann Armitage.
Ann Armitage, that's right. What is the status of these lawsuits?
The oral arguments in the civil suit were heard in May, and in July, the judge dismissed the case, and we are appealing it. I'm not a lawyer, but the best I understand is essentially the judge did not comment on the merits of the case. He basically just bucked it up because he knows that it will be decided on a much higher court than his. And we anticipate that it, in fact, will probably go all the way to the Supreme Court because there are very important legal issues at stake here. For any of your listeners want up-to-date information on where the case is and on background, there is another website, wilsonsupport.org, that would give your listeners all the up-to-date information. I think where we are right now, we're waiting for dates for the appeal.
In your testimony before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, you spoke of the, quote, creeping insidious politicization of intelligence. What does that look like right now, and how do you think it can be remedied?
Oh, I think it's terrible. My former colleagues understand what happened to me could have happened to them. But it's not just in this case. It's across the board. When I spoke earlier about the unprecedented number of visits by the vice president to CIA headquarters, I saw CIA Director Michael Hayden on Charlie Rose the other night, and he spent most of his time having to defend interrogation tactics and so forth. It really is very distracting from the mission, which is to provide cold, hard facts, intelligence, to the policymakers so that hopefully they can make wise decisions. If I were queen for a day, one of the things I would do would be divorce the director of the CIA from the presidential election cycle, make him much more independent along the lines of like the Fed chairman. It's important that the CIA director have the ear of the president for sure, but not necessarily believe that he or she needs to be on the team.
Looking at the situation of Iran and nuclear weapons, what do you think is the danger of their getting nuclear weapons, and what is the danger of Vice President Cheney's apparent desire to bomb them, and is there a third way?
There is no doubt that for over a decade, Iran has pursued a secret nuclear program. No question about that, and I think that their intent is not just peaceful. Having said that, however, I do firmly believe that we are a great nation, and great nations can afford to speak to even their enemies. And looking at how the war in Iraq has been prosecuted and the accompanying diminishment in our international credibility, our moral authority, our political authority, we are in a much weaker strategic position vis-a-vis Iran. And Iran is in the catbird seat without having to have done very much. We've done all the hard work for them. And it really is a terrible judgment on the decisions made by this administration in that part of the world.
What do you think is the right way to go in that part of the world?
Well, I think what Iran wants most is some respect. I'm not a pundit on Iran. I've been out of the agency. I've resigned in January 2006, so I certainly have no access to current intelligence. But it seems to me that great nations can afford to talk to their enemies.
You've written about, in your book, the destruction of the international institutions that have served our country so well since the end of World War II, the destruction of those institutions by the Bush administration. What are you referring to specifically?
There are so many. Where do I begin? Let's start with the fact that we are signatories to international conventions on torture, namely the Geneva Convention, which former Attorney General Gonzalez famously called quaint. I find that absolutely abhorrent. We have taken a unilateral tact, a sense of bullying the rest of the world, and look where we are. In the days after 9/11, you had the French newspaper Le Monde claiming on its headlines, "We are all Americans." We truly had the world's sympathy and their support, and that has been completely squandered.
What, at this point, do you think are the greatest dangers to our country posed by the current administration?
Again, the laundry list is long, I'm afraid. Personally, I am very concerned about the reach of this administration in its seeking to expand the executive branch at the expense of the other two branches, co-equal branches of government, and certainly at the expense of democracy. There's this so-called unitary executive theory propounded on by conservative scholars that essentially says we've been misreading the Constitution all these many years. In fact, really, the executive branch should have the premier position. And it's sort of akin to President Nixon telling David Frost, well, if the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
Right, right.
I'm using shorthand, but that really is my greatest fear. And I was pleased to see Hillary Clinton had given an interview, I think last week, that probably no one saw, but it was sort of a small item tucked away, and she was saying that should she be elected president, she would repeal some of these in these areas where the executive branch has really sought to exert its control. It appears that apparently Vice President Cheney has been seething since the days of Watergate, thinking that the presidential powers have been so grossly eroded that they need to come back in a big way, and that's a lot of what is driving what we're seeing today.
And you think that Hillary Clinton or any other executive that took the White House next would be willing to actually give up power and restore balance of power?
Well, that's a good question, but I think that we live in a democracy, thank goodness, where who's in the White House one day will be gone eventually, and keeping the original balance of power envisioned by our founding fathers is in everyone's interest.
Well, on that note, I would like to thank you very much for joining us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, Valerie Plame Wilson.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Valerie Plame Wilson, former CIA covert operations officer and author of the book Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.